Hey everyone, welcome to our weekly edition of the Out of the Woods Threat Hunting Podcast. This is Scott Poley here with Tom Kostura.
Hello everyone.
And this weekly segment features the top stories that threat hunters need to be thinking about, as well as our thoughts on the subject and hunting strategies. So with that, let's dive into the top threat hunting headlines for the week of December 16th, 2024. What do you got for us, Tom?
All right, kicking it off today, I've got an article from Elastic Labs titled Declawing Puma Kit. So Puma Kit is a new sophisticated malware that combines a dropper, two memory resident executables, a Linux kernel module rootkit, as well as a shared object user land rootkit or SO rootkit. And all of these activate under certain conditions, which we'll talk about as I kind of go on. So this was discovered through a routine threat hunt digging into virus total submissions. I thought that was a little cool side note. They were just out there digging and came across this. They identified a binary which would end up being the dropper that was named cron. It creates two memory resident executables, so memfd colon tgt and memfd colon wpn. So the tgt executable serves as basically a benign cron binary, so it makes it look legitimate, and the wpn acts as the rootkit loader. So the loader is responsible for evaluating system conditions, executing a temporary script, aptly named script.sh, which is located in the temp directory, and ultimately deploying the LKM rootkit. That rootkit contains an embedded shared object file titled the Kitsune to interact with the rootkit from user space. So this is that shared object side. The malware goes out of its way to try and remain stealthy by seemingly masquerading as common processes like cron. It will initially run a check for a keyword. That keyword that documented was H-U-I-N-D-E-R. Not even going to try to pronounce it as an actual word. But they look for that in command history. And then if it isn't found, it'll begin to unpack and execute from memory. So from there, the WPN file, which is the rootkit loader, attempts to mask itself by mimicking the user SBIN SSHD executable. It then checks for different things like secure boot being enabled and such. And if the checks pass, it loads the rootkit by dropping and executing that shell script from temp. So this script, when executed, runs various checks and file searches for compressed files using the TR command. And once the compressed file is found, it runs a tail command with a specific byte offset to extract specific portions of that. And then we'll decompress using gunzip. It also, if it can't use gunzip, we'll try things like UNXZ or bunzip too. And then down the chain into territories that were, a little unfamiliar to me, at least the depth. The rootkit portion leverages various syscall hooks like remove directory or RMDIR. This specific syscall hook allows for manipulation of directory removals, enforcing privilege escalation, gathering various configuration details in different directories and so on. That hook also has multiple checks in place for specific commands to be run, helping to conceal itself further. So there's a lot in this article. I liked it. There's a lot in the breakdown. I thought it was a really cool breakdown, and the depth of how it's functioning inside of a Linux system. It also has some ideas for detections listed, which I thought are worth looking into, though I came out with like a research question, and maybe you can expand on this a little bit too, Scott. Does Sysmon for Linux log details on details on the kernel side? So I'm fairly certain that that's something you can configure audit D to log, at least like the kernel syscall.
Yeah. I don't think there's additional logging. But that's where I think audit D is really strong, because there are, common logs that people do syslog off, or the syslog records and stuff like that you can watch for the system. And I think that's how you go about that. Now, a lot of people don't go that in depth into logging, but I mean, if I had like my perfect visibility for things I want to pull into like a SIM or some log aggregator, it would be a combination of audit D and Sysmon.
Yeah.
Because, and I say that because a lot of applications that run on Linux, for especially for business, like, you think of web servers, you think of all the other types of servers, they usually don't push their logs to standard Linux logs or the host based logs. They kind of sometimes have their own log generation, and Audit D gives you that flexibility to then grab logs from other places that are maybe more specific to that server or that implementation of that box, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that makes sense. So did you pick any nuggets out of this article? Curious what you thought.
So what I really liked was, you know, one of the things I always pay attention to when I look at investigations or look at activity in general is like, what are the things that are being used? And then if there are things that I'm not familiar with, I go down that process of like, well, is this even used in my environment? Or is this even something that, you know, like I've never seen this. What does this do and where is it used? Like just that initial investigation, it's not necessarily looking for bad, more understanding, but it can be very insightful. So one of the first things that kind of stood out to me was first you have a script being executed from the temp directory, right? You see they have basically the binsh execution in the command line. You can see /tmp/script.sh. So one, it's always good to be monitoring for .sh files for Linux because they're your bash scripts. Typically, so file creations of those and where those exist can be very informative. But also seeing them executed, it's good to have that visibility. And if they're in a weird location, you can automatically kind of alert those to the top. One of the other things that really stood out was the TR, right? It's a utility in Linux for translate character. So it's almost like a string replacement functionality, right? And when you think about it, like there's obviously legitimate reasons for this to exist because that's why it does. But you know, you think about all the obfuscation that a lot of malware authors or attack chains implement. You could expect to kind of see it in patterns like what we see here. And that's something when I said, well, who would be doing string replacement that often in your environment? Like who would be using that utility? Not saying it would never happen, but it's definitely something worth understanding. And if you don't see it, you don't even have to be crafty with types of detections and things you want to build off of it. You can just say, just alert when this happens so I can just look at it and say, yeah, it's okay or not, you know, based on, you know, how verbose that is. So that stood out. Also, it's always interesting looking for the types of patterns that attackers throw to grep for what they look for, because to me those are like key fingerprints, right? It's like if you really want to do some, not necessarily, I don't want to use the word attribution, but it's like that, right? Where these actors are looking for something very specific and they constructed this grep to be very specific to that purpose. And one, if you understand the purpose and you understand how the grep is working, it's a great tell for anyone looking for this type of behavior could be looking to do these next steps. And you have the evidence based on research, based on your analysis, things like that, to know what that is. So that's also like a really good kind of find or knowledge, you know, add. And then, you know, and when we talked about TR as being an interesting, like the attacker used DMeshes too to determine if there was secure boot enabled. Something that's interesting there is, like I said, you know, first you have DMeshes, you know, being run, and then the output of that is being piped to grep. And then, like I said, they have their key thing where they take off the S on secure, maybe because that might trigger something and you got to be careful with your keyword matches and stuff, but they're looking for boot enabled, right? Secure boot enabled, which, yeah, if someone's troubleshooting something, they may look for something similar, but I imagine that's not a common thing being searched across your environment or in your environment. So those are some good key catches and understanding why they're doing it. Like, hey, they're looking at defenses on a system and then what they need to do next, either to beat them or abort, right? So that stood out. The other thing that I thought was interesting, and I never thought of this in the past because I don't necessarily look at these logs, but an uncommon event that saved the syslog, and they called this out in the actual report as well, was it basically has like the path of the said executable started with executable stack. And that's interesting because usually in memory, that's kind of where the stack exists, right? And the stack is a place for programs to push things on top of the stack for their functions that they're going to run, values from variables based on their processing. And then when they need to jump to another part of the program or they need to extract the value they saved, they push on the stack, they pop it off. So they have like this push and pop mechanic that you kind of learn from like computer science, and they talk about what is the stack. And it's a very common data structure that's used that way. Now, granted, most of the time, and for security reasons, you know, specifically, executable data is not put on the stack. It's not intended for that purpose, but you can write executable data to the stack. And in this case, that's basically what happened. And Linux logging will tell you that. And that's what the log was, you know, started with executable stack and, you know, with the path to whatever it was started. That's a huge indication of something really weird, because that is not typical by any means for how things should be executing within the environment. So, you know, things like that, I think, are really important to pay attention to. And that's what I like about this arc. We always say Linux is kind of a weird animal for some people that aren't exposed to it. But as you kind of dig in and just pull certain things out, and, you know, especially when you have an environment to look across data that you're already collecting, that's the best way to actually figure these things out, because you can say, well, what's normal to me and what's not normal based on a report, and just spend some time doing it. But those are some key things that we mentioned here. They're worth paying attention to, and you can potentially, you know, kind of hunt across your environment for similar like behaviors, or come up with the idea of whether or not you can just build basic alerting just so you know to look at things when they appear. So,
yeah. Yeah, I like the specific call to the TR command. My first thought when I read that was, I would wager that command isn't run all of that often in environments, even heavy Linux environments. So easy, low-hanging fruit to go start digging and seeing what that kind of yields.
I want to say, I have seen it in some courses and classes I've taken in security when you're dealing with, managing data and you need to replace something to maybe change a timestamp. So if you're making a data set for something or whatever, I've seen it in that capacity. But that's, you know, like I said, very specific and would be pretty obvious, because it would be, I think the data around it would explain it too.
Right. All right. What do you got for us next?
Let's start with, one from Secure Lists. I can even locate where I've got it. So this is interesting, right? Basically, it's an APT type report, which is interesting that they call it that based on some of their analysis. But Glutton is what they're basically calling this backdoor. It's a new zero detection PHP backdoor from Win NTI targets, and they target cybercriminals. So Win NTI is considered an advanced, I think, a Chinese based advanced persistent threat perspective. But what was really interesting about this was they found this new payload they call Glutton, and it's called Glutton because it does create a PHP backdoor, but it also attacks multiple common PHP implementations. So they're saying it's Glutton because it will basically identify what kind of PHP instance or framework are using, and then it knows how to backdoor depending on that. But they also are installing the Win NTI backdoor as well. So there's two different backdoors that are being leveraged. And in their analysis, they're even talking about how the reason why that might be the case is PHP is just very adaptable and it can run on multiple operating systems very easily. So it's kind of more reliable in that aspect. But the other thing that was really interesting was the targeting set. So they were looking at this and seeing where these files and backdoors were being hosted and what they could be associated with. And they realized that a lot of places where this was being leveraged was against other cyber criminals, not just intended targets as well. And, you know, the analysis makes the claim that, you know, it might be a good chance that they're just taking advantage of the cyber criminals are also are working hard to get whatever they're trying to get, and they can kind of glean or gain from actually the hard work of these other cyber criminals by backdooring them or getting data from them through this. So that was kind of an interesting take. And obviously, you know, who are the cyber criminals going to complain to if they're getting breached by another cyber criminal type aspect? And no one's going to stand up for them in that capacity. But the other thing that makes it interesting is why they referred to the APT group. And whether it's a strong case or not. And I don't know how I feel about this or not as well, but and a lot of their coding for glutton, it doesn't have the common traits of what you call sophisticated. They consider it kind of uncharacteristically subpar for the WinNTI group. And that was, they had lack of encryption for the C2 channels. The downloader communicates over just HTTP, which you can intercept and monitor very easily. They don't obfuscate the PHP examples, meaning that all their PHP code that they write their backdoors and actions in is just plain text source code. So you can just read it very easily. And then the infrastructure for like deception purposes to make you question it, they said it was just kind of like poorly disguised because the domain it called out to was think.php1, right? So, you know, maybe it's just because of who they're attacking or who they're targeting. Maybe that's why they're doing it. They want to give away any of their tricks or fingerprints, but they want to use the same functionality because, let's be honest, sometimes you'll see the same exact attack and they just find new ways to obfuscate. And that's all they really, a lot of attackers spend their time on is how do I obfuscate or you know, get my payload across without really changing the payload much at all. So maybe that was why, but that was an interesting take, right? Is, you know, who they're targeting and the lack of effort into some of those things. The other thing that I thought was really interesting was the fact that they have the backdoor support for 22 distinct commands. And I mentioned this before, right? And that is, when you're on a Linux system, especially chmod, right, and chown, specifically chmod. But if you're going to move a payload, so they can have, they have the ability to take data and do whatever. But if they wanted to actually move a payload over, make it executable, they're likely going to have to chmod it. And it's a good thing to be on the lookout for in general. And in this case, if they were using this backdoor to do something similar, it would be an easy way to pick up on it, right? Because you'd be like, well, why is this new binary or file getting chmodded as executable so that it can execute in my environment when this is a place that shouldn't really be touched by any of those things. It's a great way to add that kind of visibility, especially when a file is being moved with no extension. So you don't really know what kind of file it is, and then it's made executable. It's very questionable in that aspect to try to like hide it, you know, so to speak. So yeah, those are some of like my key takeaways, I think. The other thing that was interesting that they did mention though, was as part of their initial infection, they had this function called do TP5 request, which basically cleans up older versions of an infection. So what that implies is that there probably already is a presence for the activity that they're doing. And this isn't the first take at all this. So it's just kind of good information to know that, hey, they've at least been successful enough to go undetected where they actually are reinfecting older things, or if they reinfect older things, they have a, they've thought about mechanisms to kind of get everything to the new standard, so to speak. So that was an interesting take, just understanding like the scale and scope of this, because, you know, they talk about how it's from a sophisticated group, an unsophisticated manner, but clearly functionally effective. And I think it's just based on their target set. So yeah, what were some of your thoughts?
Yeah, you kind of scratched on one of the pieces a little bit with the use of that secondary backdoor, leveraging the PHP client. You had talked about how, you know, it can kind of operate across multiple systems, but I thought it was also interesting, and they pointed out in this article, because going that method actually allows for, you know, higher stealth, so they can basically do fileless payload delivery, fileless execution, reducing detections, and then also like leveraging the PHP base that it helps with AV evasion. And they also point that out in the article. So, you know, one of the other things too that it seen in there is, I was curious when I was reading it, because the same as you were just thinking about, they're calling it APT, but had some of those reservations. But then I also thought, what if, you know, you think of it, you know, no honor amongst thieves, et cetera, that whole gamut. But do you think that they lacked the sophistication as more of a poke, since they were going after other cyber criminals? We're like, hey, we're getting your stuff, we don't care that you know it's us, we're planting a flag, or
cyber criminals. Like, do you think they want the same level of effort to defend themselves? I don't think so. Right.
Right. Right. Yeah. So it's kind of like maybe they just like even criminals against criminals. Maybe they're just leveraging the easy things and they're not worried about it. Smash and grab. Right. Yeah. There was also that point too where they talked about some of the kind of expansion. So they did mention one thing. I think we've talked about this tool before. Can't remember. Won't go too far into it, but the hack browser data tool. So basically, it's they were identified using the same C2 domain to distribute this tool in June of this year, and it's a legitimate tool, and it's used to like decrypt and export browser data like passwords, history, cookies. But you know, obviously, bad guys are going to use that for same deal. But they were also seen distributing that, which was interesting. But yeah, no. Oh, yeah. One other thing I did have, because this one actually is going to put me on a bit of a wire here, because I was not entirely sure what they meant by this. I was curious if you knew. I started to look it up. I will admit I only put about 10 minutes of research into it and did not come to an answer. But they mentioned as part of like the mitigating portion of this to harden temporary directories by creating a .do_not file in temp to prevent exploitation. I didn't know what that meant, and I'm still stuck on it. I was curious if you understood it.
Yeah, so it was funny in some of the training I've gone through, it was brought up as well as a way of kind of hardening. And basically what it comes down to is the /temp is kind of meant to be read by anyone. So there's some programs that sometimes drop potentially sensitive stuff in there or reference things in there. And so people can take advantage of the temp directory. But it doesn't protect from a bunch of stuff, right? So it can prevent people from deleting the entire temp and then like making their own temp directory. So, you know, they can try to use it for, you know, how they manage privileges or things that way, because if you have a file in there and it's hidden because it's .dot, you can't just delete the directory. And then obviously if that's owned by something with privileges, then they can't delete it either. Something to do also with like symbolic links, right? It can basically prevent someone from doing a sim link to that directory from another place based on some of those things. So it's not really it's not really a hard and fast measure. It just kind of becomes an impedance for some common activity that people have used to take advantage of like critical directories that, you know, to try to redirect what executes or try to, you know, take advantage or get access to specific data. Because if you think about Windows, Linux operating system, everything is file-based. Every asset in it is considered or managed like a file. And so it's just a way to use a kind of a file to help some of those restrictions. So yeah, I don't know if that was the best explanation, but it's kind of what I know about it.
I like get some pointers. I'm definitely going to dig into this because that was new to me. And, I wanted to show some ignorance to it and just kind of be curious. So I'm going to
test that one. I have not seen that mentioned in a really long time. So I was like, even when I saw it, I was like, yeah, what is that from? You know? So, but yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All right, what do you got for us?
All right, my second attack this week. So I got an article from Clarity, Research Team 82, titled Inside a New OT IoT Cyber Weapon Called IO Control. So a couple of bullets off the top here that I'm referencing directly from the article. Team 82 obtained a sample of a custom-built IoT OT malware called IO Control, and it's used by Iran-affiliated attackers to attack Israel and U.S.-based OT and IoT devices as part of a seemingly global cyber operation against Western targets. So the IO control has been used to attack IoT and SCADA OT devices for various types, including things like IP cameras, routers, PLCs, HMIs, firewalls, and so on. And some of the affected vendors include Red Lion, D-Link, and Unitronix, to name a few. So the Iran-affiliated group Cyber Avengers have taken credit to successful attacks using this malware against ORPAC systems and GasBoy fueling systems, claiming to have successfully compromised over 200 gas stations across Israel and U.S. as mentioned from their Telegram posts. These targeted fuel systems have seemingly hidden depth to them that allow for not only receiving payment information, but also over control over the pumps and nozzles, billing software access, and more. The static analysis proved tough for researchers, and they had to actively detonate to do dynamic analysis. And it was tough for one primary reason, as the malware is written in a dusty old ARM 32-bit DE CPU architecture, so it's written in old code. The malware itself leverages various syscall mechanisms that are leveraged from various GUID commands encrypted within it. It also leverages various vendor identifiers to allow it to know what values to execute and where, making it kind of seemingly and somewhat of a Swiss Army knife, in my opinion. This malware will establish persistence by setting a new RC3.d boot script and then begin command and control phases. This part is interesting in that the malware uses Cloudflare's servers to translate the host name into an IP address. In order to evade detection, the malware does not use DNS to translate this host name directly, and instead it uses DNS over HTTPS to translate it via Cloudflare's API. So basically allowing for a stealth technique to avoid detection by not sending it clear text DNS requests and instead encrypting it over the HTTPS protocol. So if you had a network tap in place, as an example, in these environments, it would just be encrypted data. You wouldn't be able to easily see what's going on. The C2 commands were issued through the MQTT protocol. And for those listening that are unaware of this, don't worry. I surely was too. MQTT is a publish subscribe network protocol that transports messages between devices. So it's basically designed for use in environments where network bandwidth is limited or unreliable. So perfect for IoT or OT areas. They leveraged this path of comms per the researchers as a further level to evade detection and kind of appear business as usual. So before passing it over to you, Scott, I really thought this article was interesting. And when I read about new OT or IoT or, you know, SCADA ICS malware, it tends to make me concerned at the level of understanding of these environments attackers are seemingly gaining versus how much I think we actually recognize and acknowledge, or frankly, even consider from a defensive position. Pure speculation on my behalf, but based on some experience in that realm myself, seeing these things is worrisome. And in my mind, kind of a call to action to dig into these environments more. I randomly pull up these OT articles, ICS articles in that light, because I just think it's an area that we should spend more time. And really the thing that gets me is every time you see a successful malware, somebody uncovers something like this, there is a real depth to the sophistication. Like, it's not tried and true behaviors typically that are leveraged because they can't in a lot of these tool sets because they're very unique, very specific. So, you know, what are your thoughts when you read through this one?
Yeah, when you talk about like the sophistication, one of the things always comes to mind with a lot of these environments is it's the technology isn't like overtly sophisticated, but what makes the like OT or IoT environments a tough target is how the technology is implemented is very important to how the attack will be successful, right? So there are environments that I think take a lot of, you know, when you talk about like reconnaissance or understanding to build out these types of attacks in a manner for you to understand these systems in this way and what to do when you get there. That's important because there's, you know, obviously there's a separate set of knowledge and skill you might need to have, but you need to have that information. So that being said, you know, these environments also aren't commonly being monitored the same way. So if someone does have access to an environment to learn, to help develop, or, you know, potentially do the actions before an attack, they're able to do so much easier, I think. And sometimes these environments are really protected, but information about these environments is not. So you look at where certain documents and configurations and all that stuff is being stored, and it's not protected the same way. You should at least be paying attention to what does access look like, how, you know, like DLP, you know, is a great example, but like, you know, is that data going somewhere or stored somewhere or accessed in a way, they could tip you that someone is at least interested, right?
because that information is important to control just for the sense of if someone really wants to understand a complex environment or have a very specific success within your environment, they would need that information. So that kind of is my piece on the sophistication aspect for a lot of these environments. But some of the other things I thought were really interesting was their use of DNS to look for the C2 over HTTP. Did so with a curl command, but even though they're doing HTTPS, for instance, the URL is the big kicker here, right? When you've got DNS-query in the URL, and especially if it's a direct IP call in this case, so you know it's a DNS provider. But that is something that you should be looking at potentially if you're worried about this, especially in these older environments. Like I know a lot of newer software technologies are starting to do a DNS over HTTP. So that just might be in your environment as a whole. But if you see DNS requests over HTTP coming from environments that uses archaic technology, that should be a huge red flag because very unlikely that is how those things were designed before this protocol even existed this way. So that's something I think that's worth paying attention to. And that's very environment specific. The other thing that I noticed too is, you know, the dropping of a bash script. So you know, like I mentioned before, anytime .sh files are created, it's important to pay attention to. But for people that aren't familiar with Linux, the you know, etc, etc, and then rc, you know, whatever, in this case is rc3.d. These are kind of like your startup scripts or boot processes, whatever you want to call them. And so if a bash script's dropped there, it's worth taking note, you know, especially since a lot of these systems don't get updated to the point where they're how they operate gets changed that often. That would be a kind of a red flag. And then in the bash script, it even points to the binary that, you know, the binary is called IO control, that existed in the bin directory. It's called out in that. So you can even use that if you investigate to kind of, well, what do I need to look at next? And you can look at timestamps, grace tile, all that kind of stuff. And then the other thing when I mentioned, profiling a system that this malware did, as part of its hello message, it ran a series of OS commands in Linux. It ran uname, hostname, who am I, date with, you know, some, and then uname dash r. And these are all basic things to basically say, like, who's the person, who's, what's the system, the timestamp, maybe helps with geolocation type stuff or whatever that is. And basically just pushing that all to a temporary file, a text file. But when we talk about recon, it's not common for all those to be run, especially in a very tight window for a person to even be doing. Like there's some times where I might use hostname or who am I, but I would never run through all these in quick succession. I don't think ever. So those are some key things of when I talked about how profiling happens early. That this is part of the hello message. So granted, it's not the profiling of the network and the configurations and things like that, but it's clearly the profiling of the second the malware hit, this is what it did. So those are some key things to pay attention to that I thought were would be effective in this case, but also good things to look out for in general.
Yeah, all good points. What do you got next for us, Scott?
So this next one, I think I previously said secure list before, and I really should have said Qwizen.com, which is the XLab. That's what the previous article with the PHP glutton backdoor. This one is from secure list, which is associated with Kaspersky. But it's interesting because Coretto is, I think, they say it's an infamous APT. I don't know if I'm that familiar with them, but they date back like 10 years ago, and maybe I didn't pay as much attention either. But basically, the article is titled Coretto is Back, What's New After 10 Years of Silence? And this is interesting because we talk about attackers' behaviors, right, and what persists and what doesn't. So it's also known, I don't know if it's translation, but it's also this actor's known as the Mask, right? And basically, they're saying it was a legendary threat actor that did really highly sophisticated attacks that go all the way back to 2007. So this is kind of like when I think about early on in my career, I don't even think I was doing cybersecurity in 2007 like I am today. So yeah, probably would not be. But they basically targeted governments, diplomatic entities, and research institutions. So very APT-ish as far as the target set and what they care about, because it's not necessarily a monetary game, but a lot of effect. But some of their new attacks, they noticed they're attacking some places in Latin America in 2022, and they were able to gain access to NDaemon email servers to kind of leverage persistence within the environment. And they're able to implant custom world clients, which is an extension that handles custom HTTP requests from the clients to the email server. So that was one way they kind of were able to do certain things. And it's clear that this runs on a Windows type server, because a lot of the references they make for the world client is .dll type file structures. But one of the things that they do are leveraged. Was they did kind of a DLL side loading, but by driver. So in this case, there was the Hitman Pro alert software. So once they kind of got in and they want to add foothold within the organization, they used a malicious XML file, which basically contained the configuration for a scheduled task. The scheduled task would then be set up to run this driver on boot or startup. Which would then do a DLL sideload of the malicious DLL that they had, but also, and I think the bat file they actually had would run the scheduled task. So it went like, I think the bat file ran the creation of the scheduled task, which installs the driver to run on boot that sideloads the DLL. That's like the order operation thing. But what's interesting, a couple notes. One, the driver, because a lot of times drivers aren't going to just load arbitrary DLLs. It doesn't check the DLL, but at least expects the DLL to exist in System 32. A lot of DLL siloing that we see from just basic user-based software is it'll check adjacent to it. So if the executable is downloaded to the download folder and it's looking for a DLL that it needs, it's going to look in the download folder right next to it. In this case, the driver is looking in a protected folder, which is System 32, which is a system-based folder for that DLL. And I say that's interesting because it's not easy just to write anything if you don't have those permissions. So whatever permissions they were able to gain in that environment also enabled them to write the malicious DLL to the System 32 directory to enable the sideloading. So there is a level of access they had to gain to get this type of foothold. But this gave them a lot of privileges to kind of inject in the WinLogin, DWN, and other things to basically typical almost, you know, espionage or spy type approach. They can steal files. They can access the microphone if there's a microphone. They can take screenshots. They can do all those types of things you'd expect. But something else that I liked that they called out here is one of the same organizations that was actually hacked by this same group in 2019, were hit again in 2022. You know, one of the things that commonly comes up is like, well, let's understand the adversary's motive and that kind of stuff, right? And the motive is supposed to determine if do I need to worry about this threat at all? Are we part of their target set? That kind of thing, right? Well, I think it's also important if you get hit by something, understanding the motive lets you know how do you need to position yourself in the future. Because sometimes if you know the attack was like, oh, I got hit with emotet, right? It might not really be targeted. It might just be you were part of the initial, you know, wash that came through with the malware and you had people that opened up emails and clicked on things, right? So when you think of like opportunistic, knowing that is good because of how you spend your resources or you know, extra approach to things, you might attack that differently versus this. They came back and hit the same target. So you should be well aware of the group if you were hit by them. And then two, what was their motive the first time? Because does that carry over the second time? And are you going to be prepared? And in this case, what I liked was they talked about the previous attacks. And what's interesting, when you talk about the attacks that date back to 2007 to 2013, all the way to the 2019, one of the most common things is the file names and the file name structure. right? And this, I think, is interesting because file names is not something that's like accidental, right? It's a decision or a tool-driven thing. And so their file structures had a slightly different extension for the first part, but it was like, you know, I forgot what you call it. Is it a tilde, the squiggly? Like little tilde, then like, you know, kind of looks like hex-based naming, like DF01AC, whatever. But same length, similar structure. One's a .temp, one's a .cmd for that specific purpose. And then there's a .nls file, the same structure, C underscore five numerical numbers. Not saying you would use that as a signature or trigger, but you'd have to expect if you were attacked and you learned something from the last attack, if they're reusing same things as file names, there's probably a lot of other things they're reusing too. And hopefully because you were already a victim, you know those, and it allows you to hunt for those things specifically, to look for other things, even though they might feel dated, or just have a better understanding in general. So, I think that's something that's really cool. And I'd say the other thing that also shows is there's a consistency with the people of the group. Sometimes groups exist and people come and go. But it sounds like this group or whoever that they've operated like this before, and there's people that have, that were operating that long ago as well. So just kind of an interesting perspective, not so much of the technical side of it, but more so on like, this is the new big adversary that came back to light, and look at how they still operate. Even the technical details aren't very verbose. You can see that they reuse a lot of the same things, even though they're considered very advanced.
Yeah, I looked into the article a little farther down the line. They actually link to a report that was presented at the Virus Bulletin conference in Dublin this year in October, where they kind of break down this threat actor. So there's some even more depth in there. A lot of it kind of echoes exactly what you were saying. When I read through the first pass, the things that really popped out to me was a lot of that kind of like back to hearkening to the whole like look for behaviorals, right? So you already mentioned stuff around the DLL side loading. You know, there's stuff in this secondary bulletin that's talking about how some of the attacks would generate scheduled tasks in a specific way. Things that we've talked about before. You might even see things like certain registry edits under the control set services area, things like that that we've talked about from a behavioral standpoint. There were a couple other things that were interesting in here though, because they mentioned an implant, a fake HMP implant, and it talked about how they were, once these implants were in place to do the things that they were driving it to do, they would actually have communication calls that were using name pipe calls between the different processes that they implanted. I thought that was interesting. But one that is, you know, going towards the area of reckless speculation, there's also something in here that I thought was, this stood out to me because it was kind of, it's not something that I typically see when you look through threat bulletins or you start talking about a threat actor. Usually you're seeing a lot of the very common things. They're trying to gather data, take data, control your systems, navigate through. You know, there's usually looking for things to sell or disrupt. But this one, they actually walk through a process where this threat actor, where they identified this threat actor, basically slaving the microphone recorder on a PC. And I thought that was very interesting to me, where it points to, okay, that's not typically done. And I would think that if you're going to do that, there's generally purpose around that, right? Mm-hmm. The technique was interesting, where it basically was a malicious DLL that was placed under C Windows. And that DLL is loaded by Explorer at each startup. And then the legitimate counterpart bearing the same name is located under the C Windows System 32, which is representing the Microsoft Pen and Touch input component. So if another DLL is present in the same path, the Explorer process loads them together with the original DLL. And as a result of that, the malicious library gets loaded into Explorer, and the malicious DLL's purpose was to record audio via the victim's microphone. So I just thought that was a little side note. I'm not going to go all the way in the reckless speculation part there, but yeah, I just thought it was cool. And I think that secondary report that was attached to this article is well worth a read, because there's a lot more technical detail in there and some of the different attacks and some more IOCs as well.
Yeah. It's always, I mean, I would say, like, we've talked a lot about a lot of the speculations on attribution more this week than we have in previous, but it's interesting to always see how people put that together or what their train of thought is and some of those things. And then, you know, Yeah. I mean, it's always fun to try to figure out the why, right? I mean, like, if we didn't care about the why, we probably wouldn't care about what we do, but,
Yeah, something that yields fruits, you know, and you get into an environment where you're looking at specific things, you see something that might affect you, or you've been affected by something. It's worth asking questions, throwing that spaghetti at the whiteboard to say, okay, why did X, Y, and Z occur? You know, is there other things we might be missing because of it? That's just good conversation to have.
Yeah, it's healthy conversation, especially amongst peers trying to solve the same problems, you know. All right, well, I think that closes out. So I really want to thank everyone for joining our Out of the Woods Threat Hunting podcast this week. Looking forward to syncing back up next week. And with that, that closes out our top threat hunting headlines for the week of December 16th, 2024.
Happy hunting, everyone.
Happy hunting.